Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's Mirsky and Company podcast, bringing you in-depth analysis on trending legal issues in media, new media, intellectual property, and privacy. I'm Andrew Mirsky, principal of Mirsky and Company, LLC, a Washington, D.C. law firm with a practice in new media, intellectual property, technology, and nonprofits. Today, we'll be covering trademark cases from both the United States and European Union courts involving major search engines such as Google and Yahoo. In particular, we're going to look at whether and how search engines can be held responsible for trademark infringement when advertisers buy search result advertisements using the trademark names of their competitors. My guest today is Howard Hogan, a partner in Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher's Washington, D.C. office. Howard's practice focuses on intellectual property litigation and counseling, including trademark, copyright, patent, false advertising, licensing, media and entertainment, and trade secret matters. Howard, thank you for joining me today.
Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Howard. Let's give some background. I'm going to give a little bit of background and then go right into a couple of questions with Howard. The background is Google's popular and dominant advertising service, AdWords, allows companies to place auction-style bids on search keywords. If a company bids the highest amount on a keyword, the company's ad comes up first when someone searches the keyword. That's the basic premise. The company then pays Google on a pay-per-click basis. So far, so good. The trademark issue arises because in many countries, including the United States, the search engines, Google among them, Yahoo, and others, allow companies to advertise. They allow advertisers to advertise next to search results using the advertiser's competitors' trademarks. It's important to distinguish between the cases that trademark owners have brought against search engines themselves, which is what we're going to talk about here, and the cases that trademark owners have brought against the advertisers who pay the search engines for the right to use their competitors' trademarks as triggers for the advertising. There are many U.S. cases involving advertisers purchasing competitors' marks where courts have found in favor of the trademark owner and a few where the courts have found against the trademark owner. While these cases have their own issues and problems, the stakes in the cases against the search engines, either as direct or contributory infringers of trademarks, the stakes are higher because a decision against the search engines could affect many, if not all, search engine advertisers and, in fact, the search engine advertising business in the first place. Howard, my first question is I'd like you to talk about if you can briefly tell us what happened in the American Airlines cases against Google and Yahoo.
Certainly. The first of these cases was filed by American Airlines against Google in August of 2007. My firm and I represented American Airlines in both of them. The first was closely watched because there was some hope that with two substantial companies going head-to-head, the results would help clarify the law in this area. Right out of the gate, Google filed a detailed motion to dismiss, raising a host of issues, including the use and commerce issue and the statutory immunity issue for Internet service providers that is created in the Communications Decency Act. Judge McBride denied Google's motion with a one-paragraph opinion, so there wasn't a comprehensive opinion settling the law in this area. The case then proceeded to discovery and settled on the eve of a hearing on Americans' motion to strike Google's answer because of its failure to provide certain electronic records of the sponsored link advertisements. I will say that through the course of discovery, I did see considerable evidence that suggests that a substantial number of Internet users really can't tell the difference between these forms of advertising, these sponsored links, and the organic links themselves. And many do think that the links that Google or Yahoo puts in these spots are what Google or Yahoo is telling the Internet user are the most relevant search results. Google and Yahoo obviously have a different view of this. But after the Google case settled, American hired us to promptly bring a similar suit against Yahoo.
My follow-up question on that, Howard, is what was the significance and outcome of Yahoo's effort in those cases to argue that the case is dependent, there was this whole argument that the case is dependent on the existence of a contract between American Airlines and Yahoo?
Sure. The case against Yahoo was also assigned to Judge McBride in the Eastern District of Texas. Yahoo did not bother to repeat Google's motion to dismiss. Instead, it moved to transfer the case back to its home district, the Northern District of California, based on the fact that American's ad agency had placed advertisements for American with Yahoo. Judge McBride ruled that the Yahoo advertising agreement could not control American's trademark claims because they did not depend on the existence of that advertising agreement. The Fifth Circuit affirmed on Yahoo's petition for a writ of mandamus. The case was settled also on the eve of a hearing seeking to sanction Yahoo for discovery misconduct.
That brings us to the next case I want to talk about, the next U.S. case, that is. It's a slightly more recent case involving Google, being litigated in the federal courts in Virginia, specifically a case brought by the language company Rosetta Stone. This is a case going on in the federal court in Alexandria. A decision was issued this past summer, and it's now on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. A summary judgment decision was issued by the district court this past August. Howard, talk about, if you would, the technical issue in this case of the difference between two different sections of the Lanham Act that were at stake here. One is the one that was relied upon by the court, Section 32.1, and the other was not relied upon, Section 43A, and what happened here. Or in other words, the difference and significance of source confusion in this case versus sponsorship or endorsement confusion.
Yes, Judge Lee's decision evaluates Rosetta Stone's trademark claims under Section 32.1 of the Lanham Act, which provides a cause of action against any person who uses in commerce any reproductions, counterfeits, copies, or colorable imitations of a registered mark that is likely to cause confusion or mistake or to deceive. Judge Lee ruled that the case turned on whether Google's practice of auctioning Rosetta Stone marks as keyword triggers for sponsored links and allowing their use within sponsored links, text, or title is likely to create confusion among consumers as to the source or origin of Rosetta Stone's goods or services. There are a few problems with that. Most importantly, it ignores Section 43A of the Lanham Act, which creates a much broader cause of action against any person who uses in commerce any word, term, name, symbol, or device, or any combination, or any false designation of origin, false or misleading description of fact, false or misleading representation of fact, that is likely to cause confusion or a mistake or to deceive. And it specifies that the mistake can be as to affiliation, connection, or association of the person or with another person, or as to the origin, sponsorship, or approval of the goods or services or commercial activities of the other person. This is generally referred to as association, sponsorship, or endorsement confusion. Any of those terms are used interchangeably in the case law. As a result, Rosetta Stone should have a cause of action, and it did plead one, trying to prove that Google's use of the mark causes consumers to be confused into thinking that Google's ads are connected or sponsored or associated with Rosetta Stone. Judge Lee, however, only evaluated the more limited question of product confusion, that is, the confusion as to who is the source of Google's own goods or services, and concluded there is no evidence that Google is attempting to pass off Google's goods or services as Rosetta Stone's.
And we talked before the call, we talked briefly about this one point because this struck me as a real basic premise problem, and I know it's a basic problem that's being appealed. Essentially, the question of what happened and why do you think, and there's conflicting case law and overturned decisions and so forth on whether or not 43A should be applied to a case like this. What do you think is going on in this case? If you had to speculate, and I guess you only can speculate because the appeal hasn't been ruled upon yet.
Yes, it would be easier if there was some part of Judge Lee's decision that explicitly said that 43A doesn't apply. But this is an area of the law that is unfamiliar to many federal judges. And, in fact, you do see appellate decisions from time to time reversing judges for making the same fundamental mistake. They look at previous decisions that really do evaluate source confusion and then try to apply those source confusion decisions to a complaint that is pled more broadly. For example, in the famous Horse versus Fifth Avenue Photo Inc. decision out of the Second Circuit in October 2010, the Second Circuit reversed a district judge for making a similar mistake. I can only speculate that it is a mistake along those lines and that Judge Lee did not consciously decide that the 43A claims do not apply.
Another question in Rosetta Stone that came up was the issue of the functionality doctrine. Can you talk a little bit about that and what was going on there?
Sure. In addition to the confusion analysis, the court also applied a novel defense to a particular form of trademark claims. In most trademark cases where a company uses another company's trademark, such as in comparative advertising, the question is whether the use is fair use. Now, there is a multi-part test for the fair use defense, specifically the nominative fair use defense, but it basically boils down to whether the defendant's use of the plaintiff's mark will confuse consumers as to the source of the goods. The use is fair if there's no danger that consumers are going to be confused. Judge Lee did not use that analysis. Instead, he applied what's called the functionality defense. The functionality defense arises from a kind of trademark claim called trade dress infringement. The idea of trade dress infringement is that if one company uses packaging that is likely to make consumers think its product is the product of another company, it can be liable for trade dress infringement. Think of a company that makes a bottle that looks identical to Coke's bottle. But if the aspect of the packaging at issue is functional rather than ornamental or decorative, then courts generally will not allow the creator of the original packaging to get a trademark monopoly because inventions are generally the province of patent law, not trademark law. Here, Judge Lee ruled that the functionality defense could apply to Google's use of words because they were functional to making the search engines work. I think this may be the first time the functionality defense has been applied in a case in this context.
You started to talk about, and I guess this was sort of the implication of my question about the 43A, 32-1 distinction. It's not difficult to characterize these cases as rather, at least in the U.S., very pro-search engine. What do you think seems to be the trend in the cases brought against the search engines? Again, to be clear, against the search engines as opposed to against the advertisers, what do you think of this? How would you characterize the trend in the U.S.?
Yes, I think it's safe to say that since the end of the American Airlines cases, which both settled, Google has been on a winning streak in these cases. In both Rosetta Stone and another case in California, courts have ruled for Google on these threshold motions. It will be interesting to see if that streak continues when the Fourth Circuit rules in the Rosetta Stone case. I think it's interesting, though, that in the last few weeks, Google has changed the name of its sponsored links from the term sponsored links, which many people find confusing, to ads. You know, I've seen enough research that indicates that consumers may be confused regardless because of the visual cues and the placement on the page. But ads is a different term than sponsored links.
The second part of our conversation today has to do with Europe. And I'll give some quick background here. Before this past year, before 2010, it was clear that at least in France and Germany, search engines could not sell trademarks, and Google's policy reflected that. A couple of things changed in 2010 in Europe. First, there was a decision in March in the European Court of Justice, the ECJ, in a case involving Louis Vuitton. As I understand it, the EU court in that case, in the March case, deferred to the individual national courts, the courts of France, Belgium, Germany, et cetera, on the question of liability. But they ruled that a trademark owner, the individual or entity claiming infringement, they must demonstrate that Google, or the search engine, played an active role in creating the advertisements at issue. Is that a correct reading of what happened starting in March in Europe?
Yes, the ECJ did focus on this question of whether Google played an active role in creating the advertisements. But it also held that Google could be liable if it failed to act expeditiously to remove or disable access to ads after it obtained knowledge of the unlawful nature of the ads. The bottom line seems to be that the courts in Europe are shifting the burden to trademark owners to search for confusing uses of the marks in search engine advertising and then bring them to the search engine's attention. And then if the search engines fail to stop confusing ads, there may be liability against the search engines. But the ECJ did not prevent trademark owners from pursuing claims against the advertisers themselves, who are directly responsible for confusing sponsored link ads.
Okay, so then the next thing that happened, as I mentioned, it was an ECJ opinion that directed liability questions to the national courts, and you saw a number of these cases. We'll talk about one in particular this past fall involving, and my French is terrible, I'll just use the acronym SFL case in Paris in, I think, October. This case was actually a review of a previous case from 2007 before the March ECJ case. And in the 2007 case, I think it was 2007, there was a finding of liability against Google. In the case this past October involving SFL and Google, the previous finding of liability was overturned. However, the court was unwilling to rule that Google was completely exempt from possible liability, just that in this case, it had no liability. It couldn't be exempt from liability, but it just didn't happen to have liability in this case. Can you discuss your thoughts on this case and what was sort of this forebodes for these kinds of actions in Europe, these activities?
Of course. In the SFL case, the court ruled that the appearance of the SFL trademark on Google's AdWords did not constitute proof that Google had infringed the trademark. But one key issue was the application of a liability exclusion provided under a European Union directive and France's 2004 law to establish confidence in the digital economy that is known as the LCEN. The court rejected Google's argument that it should be completely exempt because it functioned mainly as a caretaker, doing no management or billing, but it ultimately concluded, even though Google wasn't exempt, that SFL failed to prove that Google's direct involvement in the advertiser's choice of keywords and display of sponsored links was created liability. You know, I don't know enough about the relationship between Google and the particular advertisers at issue in the SFL case, but I do know that Google offers a lot of services to help its advertisers optimize their ad experience and ultimately to increase their ad budgets. So it's possible that on different facts, a French court could come out a different way and find Google to be, for lack of a better term, contributorily liable for sponsored links that cause confusion.
Some great insights here, Howard. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to thank Howard for joining us today, and I want to thank our audience. We hope to have Howard on the podcast again soon for these and other topics. For our listeners, you can reach Howard. Howard's last name is Hogan, Howard Hogan. He's at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher here in Washington, D.C. His telephone is 202-887-3640 or by email, HHOGAN at Gibson, Dunn, GIBSONDUNN.com. I'm Andrew Mirsky. I can be reached at 202-339-0303. Or by email, Andy at Mirsky Legal. That's MIRSKY Legal.com. Thank you, Howard, and thank you to our audience. Happy New Year to everybody, and thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next week.